my baby was going to be. Lysa, Catelyn said, if you're right about the Lannisters, all the more reason we must act quickly. We... Not in front of the baby, Lysa said. He has a delicate temper. Don't you, sweet one? The boy is Lord of the Eyrie and Defender of the Vale, Catelyn reminded her. And these are no times for delicacy. Ned thinks it may come to war. Quiet! Lysa snapped at her. You're scaring the boy. Little Robert took a quick peek over his shoulder at Catelyn and began to tremble. His doll fell to the rushes, and he pressed himself against his mother. Don't be afraid, my sweet baby, Lysa whispered. Mother's here. Nothing will hurt you. She opened her robe and drew out a pale, heavy breast tipped with red. The boy grabbed for it eagerly, buried his face against her chest, and began to suck. Lysa stroked his hair. Catelyn was at a loss for words. John Aaron's son, she thought, incredulously. She remembered her own baby, 3-year-old Rickon, half the age of this boy and 5 times as fierce. Small wonder the Lords of the Vale were restive. For the first time she understood why the king had tried to take the child away from his mother to fuss over the Lannisters. We're safe here, Lysa was saying. Whether to her or to the boy, Catelyn was not sure. Don't be a fool, Catelyn said, her anger rising in her. No one is safe. If you think hiding here will make the Lannisters forget you, you are sadly mistaken. Lysa covered the boy's ear with her hand. Even if they could bring an army through the mountains and past the bloody gates, the area is impregnable. You saw for yourself, no enemy could ever reach us up here. Catelyn wanted to slap her. Uncle Brynden had tried to warn her, she realized. No castle is impregnable. This one is, Lysa insisted. Everyone says so. The only thing is, what am I to do with this imp you've brought me?
Is he a bad man?
The Lord of the Eyrie asked, his mother's breast popping from his mouth, the nipple wet and red. A very bad man, Lysa told him as she covered herself. But mother won't let him harm my little baby.
Make him fly,
Robert said eagerly. Lysa stroked her son's hair. Perhaps we will, she murmured. Perhaps that is just what we will do. Eddard. He found Littlefinger in the brothel's common room, chatting amiably with a tall, elegant woman who wore a feathered gown over skin as black as ink. By the hearth, Hewitt and a buxom wench were playing at forfeits. From the look of it, he'd lost his belt, his cloak, his mail shirt, and his right boot so far, while the girl had been forced to unbutton her shift to the waist. Jorry Cassell stood beside a rain-streaked window with a wry smile on his face, watching Hewitt turn over tiles and enjoying the view. Ned paused at the foot of the stair and pulled on his gloves. It's time we took our leave. My business here is done. Hewitt lurched to his feet, hurriedly gathering up his things. As you will, my lord, Jorry said. I'll out, Will, bring round the horses. He strode to the door. Littlefinger took his time saying his farewells. He kissed the black woman's hand, whispered some joke that made her laugh aloud, and sauntered over to Ned. Your business, he said lightly, or Robert's? They say the hand dreams the king's dreams, speaks the king's voice, and rules with the king's sword. Does that also mean you fuck with the king's... Lord Baelish, Ned interrupted. You presume too much. I'm not ungrateful for your help. It might have taken us years to find this brothel without you. That does not mean I intend to endure your mockery, and I am no longer the king's hand. The direwolf must be a prickly beast, said Littlefinger with a sharp twist of his mouth. A warm rain was pelting down from a starless black sky as they walked to the stables. Ned dropped the hood of his cloak. Jorry brought out his horse. Young Will came right behind him, leading Littlefinger's mare with one hand, while the other fumbled with his belt and the lacings of his trousers. A barefoot whore leaned out of the stable door, giggling at him. Will we be going back to the castle now, my lord? Jory asked. Ned nodded and swung into the saddle. Littlefinger mounted up beside him. Jory and the others followed. Chateau runs a choice establishment, Littlefinger said as they rode. I've half a mind to buy it. Brothels are a much sounder investment than ships, I've found. Whores seldom sink. And when they are boarded by pirates, why, the pirates pay good coin like everyone else. Lord Petar chuckled at his own wit. Ned let him prattle on. After a time, he quieted and they rode in silence. The streets of King's Landing were dark and deserted. The rain had driven everyone under their roofs. It beat down on Ned's head, warm as blood and relentless as old guilts. Fat drops of water ran down his face. Robert would never keep to one bed, Lyanna had told him at Winterfell, on the night long ago when their father had promised her hand to the young lord of Storm's End. I hear he has gotten a child on some girl in the Vale. Ned had held the babe in his arms. He could scarcely deny her, nor would he lie to his sister. But he had assured her that what Robert did before their betrothal was of no matter, that he was a good man and true, who would love her with all his heart. Lyanna had only smiled. Love is sweet, dearest Ned, but it cannot change a man's nature. The girl had been so young. Ned had not dared to ask her age. No doubt she'd been a virgin. The better brothels could always find a virgin if the purse was fat enough. She had light red hair with a powdering of freckles across the bridge of her nose, and when she slipped free a breast to give her nipple to the babe, he saw that her bosom was freckled as well. I named her Barra, she said, as the child nurse. She looks so like him, does she not, my lord? She has his nose and his hair. She does, Eddard Stark had touched the baby's fine dark hair. It flowed through his fingers like black silk. Robert's firstborn had had the same fine hair, he seemed to recall. Tell him that when you see him, my lord, as it please you. Tell him how beautiful she is. I will, Ned had promised her. That was his curse. Robert would swear on dying love and forget them before evenfall. But Ned Stark kept his vows. He thought of the promises he'd made Lyanna as she lay dying and the price he'd paid to keep them.
And tell him I've not been with no one else. I swear it, my lord, by the old gods and you. Shataya said I could have half a year for the baby and for hoping he'd come back. So you'll tell him I'm waiting, won't you? I don't want no jewels or nothing, just him. He was always good to me, truly.
Good to you, Ned thought hollowly. I will tell him, child, and I promise you, Barra shall not go wanting. She had smiled then, a smile so tremulous and sweet that it cut the heart out of him. Riding through the rainy night, Ned saw Jon Snow's face in front of him, so like the younger version of his own. If the gods frowned so on bastards, he thought dully, why did they fill men with such lusts? Lord Baelish, what do you know of Robert's bastards? Well, he has more than you, for a start. How many? Littlefinger shrugged. Rivulets of moisture twisted down the back of his cloak. Does it matter? If you bed enough women, some will give you presents, and his grace has never been shy on that count. I know he's acknowledged that boy at Storm's End, the one he fathered the night Lord Stannis wed. He could hardly do otherwise. The mother was a Florent, niece to Lady Selyse, one of her bedmaids. Renly says that Robert carried the girl upstairs during the feast and broke in the wedding bed while Stannis and his bride were still dancing. Lord Stannis seemed to think that was a blot on the honour of his wife's house. So when the boy was born, he shipped him off to Renly. He gave Ned a sideways glance. I've also heard whispers that Robert got a pair of twins on a serving wench at Castle Rock 3 years ago when he went west for Lord Tywin's tourney. Cersei had the babes killed and sold the mother to a passing slaver. too much an affront to Lannister pride that close to home. Ned Stark grimaced. Ugly tales like that were told of every great lord in the realm. He could believe it as Cersei Lannister readily enough, but would the king stand by and let it happen? The Robert he had known would not have, but the Robert he had known had never been so practiced at shutting his eyes to things he did not wish to see. Why would John Arryn take a sudden interest in the king's base-born children? The short man gave a sudden shrug. He was the king's hand. Doubtless, Robert asked him to see they were provided for. Ned was soaked through to the bone and his soul had grown cold. It had to be more than that, or why kill him? Littlefinger shook the rein from his hair and laughed. Now I see. Lord Arryn learned that his grace had filled the bellies of some whores and fishwives, and for that he had to be silenced. Small wonder. Allow a man like that to live, and next he's likely to blurt out that the sun rises in the east. There was no answer Ned Stark could give to that but a frown. For the first time in years, he found himself remembering Rhaegar Targaryen. He wondered if Rhaegar had frequented brothels. Somehow he thought not. The rain was falling harder now, stinging the eyes and drumming against the ground. Rivers of black water were running down the hill when Jory called out, "My lord!" His voice hoarse with alarm. And in an instant, the street was full of soldiers. Ned glimpsed ringmail over leather, gauntlets and greaves, steel helms with golden lions on the crests. Their cloaks clung to their backs sudden with rain. He had no time to count, but there were 10 at least, a line of them, on foot, blocking the street with long swords and iron-tipped spears. "Behind!" he heard Will cry, and when he turned his horse, there were more in back of them, cutting off their retreat. Jory's sword came singing from its scabbard. "Make way or die!" "The wolves are howling," their leader said. Ned could see rain running down his face. Such a small pack, though. Littlefinger walked his horse forward, step by careful step. "What is the meaning of this?" "This is the hand of the king." He was the hand of the king. The mud muffled the hooves of the blood-based stallion. The lion parted before him. On a golden breastplate, the Lion of Lannister roared its defiance. Now, if truth be told, I'm not sure what he is. "Lannister, this is madness," Littlefinger said. "Let us pass. We're expected back at the castle. What do you think you're doing?" "He knows what he's doing," Ned said calmly. Jaime Lannister smiled. "Quite true. I'm looking for my brother. You remember my brother, don't you, Lord Stark? He was with us at Winterfell. Fair-haired, mismatched eyes, sharp of tongue, a short man." "I remember him well," Ned replied. "It would seem he has met some trouble on the road. My lord father is quite vexed. You would not perchance have any notion of who might have wished my brother ill, would you? Your brother has been taken at my command to answer for his crimes," Ned Stark said. Littlefinger groaned in dismay. "Oh, my lords." Sir Jaime ripped the longsword from his sheath and urged his stallion forward. "Show me your steel, Lord Eddard. I'll butcher you like Ares if I must. But I'd sooner you died with a blade in your hand." He gave Littlefinger a cool, contemptuous glance. "Lord Baelish, I'd leave here in some haste if I did not care to get bloodstains on my costly clothing." Littlefinger did not need to be urged. "I will bring the city watch," he promised Ned. The Lannister line parted to let him through and closed behind him. Littlefinger put his heels to his mare and vanished around a corner. Ned's men had drawn their swords, but there were 3 against 20. Eyes watched from nearby windows and doors, but no one was about to intervene. His party was mounted, the Lannisters on foot, save for Jaime himself. A charge might win them free, but it seemed to Eddard Stark that they had a surer, safer tactic. "Kill me," he warned the Kingslayer, "and Catelyn will most certainly slay Tyrion." Jaime Lannister poked at Ned's chest with with a gilded sword that had sipped the blood of the last of the Dragon Kings. Would she? The noble Catelyn Tully of Riverrun murder a hostage? I think not, he sighed. But I'm not willing to chance my brother's life on a woman's honour. Jaime slid the golden sword into its sheath. So I suppose I'll let you run back to Robert to tell him how I've frightened you. I wonder if he'll care. Jaime pushed his wet hair back with his fingers and wheeled his horse around. When he was beyond the line of swordsmen, he glanced back at his captain. Tregar, see that no harm comes to Lord Stark. As you say, my lord. Still, we wouldn't want him to leave here entirely unchastened, so... Through the night and the rain, he glimpsed the white of Jaime's smile. Kill his men. No! Ned Stark screamed, clawing for his sword. Jaime was already cantering off down the street as he heard Will shout. Men closed from both sides. Ned rode one down, cutting at phantoms in red cloaks who gave way before him. Jorah Cassel put his heels into his mount and charged. A steel shod hoof caught a Lannister guardsman in the face with a sickening crunch. A second man reeled away, and for an instant Jorah was free. Will cursed as they pulled him off his dying horse, sword slashing in the rain. Ned galloped to him, bringing his longsword down on Tregar's helm. The jolt of impact made him grit his teeth. Tregar stumbled to his knees, his lion crest sheared in half, blood running down his face. Hewitt was hacking at the hands that had seized his bridle when a spear caught him in the belly. Suddenly, Jorah was back among them, a red rain flying from his sword. No! Ned shouted. Jorah, away! Ned's horse slipped under him and came crashing down in the mud. There was a moment of blinding pain and the taste of blood in his mouth. He saw them cut the legs from Jorah's mount and drag him to the earth, swords rising and falling as they closed in around him. When Ned's horse lurched back to its feet, he tried to rise, but only to fall again, choking on his scream. He could see the splintered bone poking through his calf. It was the last thing he saw for a time. The rain came down and down and down. When he opened his eyes again, Lord Eddard Stark was alone with his dead. His horse moved closer, caught the rank smell of blood, and galloped away. Ned began to drag himself through the mud, gritting his teeth at the agony in his leg. It seemed to take years. Faces watched from candlelit windows, and people began to emerge from alleys and doors, but no one moved to help. Littlefinger and the city watch found him there in the street, cradling Jorah Cassel's body in his arms. Somewhere the gold cloaks found a litter, but the trip back to the castle was a blur of agony, and Ned lost consciousness more than once. He remembered seeing the Red Keep looming ahead of him in the first grey light of dawn. The rain had darkened the pale pink stone of the massive walls to the colour of blood. Then Grand Maester Pycelle was looming over him, holding a cup, whispering, "Drink, my lord, here, the milk of the poppy, for your pain." He remembered swallowing, and Pycelle was telling someone to heat the wine to boiling and fetch him clean silk, and that was the last he knew. Daenerys. The horse gate of Vaes Dothrak was made of two gigantic bronze stallions, rearing, their hooves meeting 100 feet above the roadway to form a pointed arch. Daenerys could not have said why the city needed a gate when it had no walls and no buildings that she could see. Yet there it stood, immense and beautiful, the great horses framing the distant purple mountain beyond. The bronze stallions threw long shadows across the waving grasses as Khal Drogo led the Khalasar under their hooves and down the guard's way, his blood riders beside him. Dany followed on her silver, escorted by Ser Jorah Mormont, and her brother Viserys mounted once more. After the day in the grass, when she had left him to walk back to the Khalasar, the Dothraki had laughingly called him Khal-Re-Mar, the Sore-Foot King. Khal Drogo had offered him a place in a cart the next day, and Viserys had accepted. In his stubborn ignorance, he had not even known he was being mocked. The carts were for eunuchs, cripples, women giving birth, the very young and the very old. That won him yet another name, Khal Ragat, the Cart King. Her brother had thought it was the Khal's way of apologizing for the wrong Dany had done him. She had begged Ser Jorah not to tell him the truth, lest he be shamed. The knight had replied that the king could well do with a bit of shame. Yet he had done as she bid. It had taken much pleading and all the pillow tricks Doria had taught her before Dany had been able to make Drogo relent and allow Viserys to rejoin them at the head of the column. "Where is the city?" she asked, as they passed underneath the bronze arch. There were no buildings to be seen, no people, only the grass and the road, lined with ancient monuments from all the lands the Dothraki had sacked over the centuries. "Ahead," Ser Jorah answered, "under the mountain." Beyond the horse gate, plundered guards and stolen heroes loomed on either side of them. The forgotten deities of dead cities brandished their broken thunderbolts at the sky as Dany rode her silver past their feet. Stone kings looked down on her from their thrones, their faces chipped and stained, even their names lost in the mists of time. Lithe young maidens danced on marble plinths draped only in flowers or poured air from shattered jars. Monsters stood in the grass beside the road, black iron dragons with jewels for eyes, roaring griffins, manticores with their barbed tails poised to strike, and other beasts she could not name. Some of the statues were so lovely they took her breath away, others so misshapen and terrible that Dany could scarcely bear to look at them. Those, Ser Jorah said, had likely come from the shadowlands beyond the Ashai. "So many," she said, as her silver stepped slowly onward, "and from so many lands." Viserys was less impressed. "The trash of dead cities," he sneered. He was careful to speak in the common tongue, which few Dothraki could understand. Yet even so, Dany found herself glancing back at the men in her cars to make sure he had not been overheard. He went on bitterly, "All these savages know how to do is steal things better men have built and kill." He laughed. "Oh, they do know how to kill. Otherwise, I'd have no use for them at all." "They are my people now," Dany said. "You should not call them savages, brother." "The dragon speaks as he likes," Viserys said, in the common tongue. He glanced over his shoulder at Aego and Ricaro riding behind them, and favored them with a mocking smile. "See, the savages lack the wit to understand the speech of civilized men." A moss-eaten stone monolith loomed over the road, 50 feet tall. Viserys glanced at it with boredom in his eyes. "How long must we linger amongst these ruins before Drogo gives me my army? I grow tired of waiting." "The princess must be presented to the Dushkaleen." "The crones, yes," her brother interrupted. "And there's to be some mummer's show of a prophecy for the whelp in her belly, you tell me. What is that to me? I'm tired of eating horse meat, and I'm sick of the stink of these savages." He sniffed at the wide, floppy sleeves of his tunic, where it was his custom to keep a sachet. It could not have helped much. The tunic was filthy. All the silk and heavy wools that Viserys had worn out of Pentos were stained by hard travel and rotted from sweat. Ser Jorah Mormont said, "The Western Market will have food more to your taste, Your Grace. The traders from the free cities come there to sell their wares. The Khal will honor his promise in his own time."
"He had better," Viserys said grimly. "I was promised a crown, and I mean to have it. The dragon is not mocked."
Spying an obscene likeness of a woman with six breasts and a ferret's head, he rode off to inspect it more closely. Danny was relieved, yet no less anxious. I pray that my sun and stars will not keep him waiting too long, she told Sir Jorah when her brother was out of earshot. The knight looked after Viserys doubtfully. Your brother should have bided his time in Pentos. There's no place for him in a Kalasar. Illyrio tried to warn him. He will go as soon as he has his 10,000. My lord husband promised a golden crown. Sir Jorah grunted. Yes, Khaleesi, but the Dothraki look on these things differently than we do in the West. I have told him as much, as Illyria told him, but your brother does not listen. The horse lords are no traders. Viserys thinks he's sold you, and now he wants his price. Yet Khal Drogo would say he had you as a gift. He will give Viserys a gift in return, yes, in his own time. You do not demand a gift, not of a Khal. You do not demand anything of a Khal. It's not right to make him wait. Danny did not know why she was defending her brother, yet she was. Viserys says he could sweep the Seven Kingdoms with 10,000 Dothraki screamers. Sir Jorah snorted. Viserys could not sweep a stable with 10,000 brooms. Danny could not pretend to surprise at the disdain in his tone. What if it were not Viserys, she asked. If it were someone else who led them, someone stronger, could the Dothraki truly conquer the Seven Kingdoms? Sir Jorah's face grew thoughtful as their horses trod together down the God's Way. When I first went into exile, I looked at the Dothraki and saw half-naked barbarians, as wild as their horses. If you'd asked me then, Princess, I should have told you that 1,000 good knights would have no trouble putting to flight 100 times as many Dothraki. But if I asked you now... Now, the knight said, I'm less certain. They're better riders than any knight, utterly fearless, and their bows outrange ours. In the Seven Kingdoms, most archers fight on foot, from behind a shield wall or a barricade of sharpened stakes. The Dothraki fire from horseback, charging or retreating, it makes no matter. They are full as deadly. And there are so many of them, my lady. Your lord husband alone counts 40,000 mounted warriors in his Kalasar. Is that truly so many? Your brother Rhaegar brought as many men to the Trident, Sir Jorah admitted. But of that number, no more than a tenth were knights. The rest were archers, free riders, and foot soldiers armed with spears and pikes. When Rhaegar fell, many threw down their weapons and fled the field. How long do you imagine such a rabble would stand against a charge of 40,000 screamers howling for blood? How well would boiled leather jerkins and mail shirts protect them when the arrows fall like rain? Not long, she said. Not well. He nodded. Mind you, Princess, if the lords of the Seven Kingdoms have the wit the guards gave a goose, it will never come to that. The riders have no taste for siegecraft. I doubt they could take even the weakest castle in the Seven Kingdoms. But if Robert Baratheon were fool enough to give them battle... Is he? Danny asked. A fool, I mean. Sir Jorah considered that for a moment. Robert should have been born Dothraki, he said at last. Your Khal will tell you that only a coward hides behind stone walls instead of facing his enemy with a blade in hand. The usurper would agree. He's a strong man, brave, and rash enough to meet a Dothraki horde in the open field. But the men around him, well, their pipers play a different tune. His brother Stannis, Lord Tywin Lannister, Eddard Stark, he spat. You hate this Lord Stark, Danny said. He took from me all that I loved for the sake of a few lice-ridden poachers and his precious honor, Sir Jorah said bitterly. From his tone, she could tell the lust still pained him. He changed the subject quickly. There, he announced, pointing. Vaes Dothrak, the city of the horse lords. Khal Drogo and his blood riders led them through the great bazaar of the Western Market, down the broad ways beyond. Danny followed, close on her silver, staring at the strangeness about her. Vaes Dothrak was at once the largest city and the smallest that she had ever known. She thought it must be 10 times as large as Pentos, a vastness without walls or limits, its broad, windswept streets paved in grass and mud and carpeted with wild flowers. In the free cities of the West, towers and manses and hovels and bridges and shops and halls all crowded in on one another. But Vase Dothrak sprawled languorously, baking in the warm sun, ancient, arrogant, and empty. Even the buildings were so queer to her eyes. She saw carved stone pavilions, manses of woven grass as large as castles, rickety wooden towers, step pyramids faced with marble, log halls open to the sky. In place of walls, some palaces were surrounded by thorny hedges. None of them are alike, she said. Your brother had part of the truth, Sir Jorah admitted. The Dothraki do not build. 1,000 years ago, to make a house, they would dig a hole in the earth and cover it with a woven grass roof. The buildings, you see, were made by slaves brought here from lands they've plundered, and they built each after the fashion of their own peoples. Most of the halls, even the largest, seem deserted. Where are the people who live here? Danny asked. The bazaar had been full of running children and men shouting, but elsewhere she had seen only a few eunuchs going about their business. Only the crones of the Dashkaleen dwell permanently in the sacred city, them and their slaves and servants, Sir Jorah replied. Yet Vase Dothrak is large enough to house every man of every Khalasar, should all the Khals return to the mother at once. The crones have prophesied that one day that will come to pass, so Vase Dothrak must be ready to embrace all its children. Khal Drogo finally called a halt near the Eastern Market, where the caravans from Yiti and Ashayi and the Shadowlands came to trade, with the Mother of Mountains looming overhead. Danny smiled as she recalled Magister Illyria's slave girl and her talk of a palace with 200 rooms and doors of solid silver. The palace was a cavernous wooden feasting hall, its rough-hewn timbered walls rising 40 feet, its roof sewn silk, a vast billowing tent that could be raised to keep out the rare rains or lowered to admit the endless sky. Around the hall were broad, grassy horse yards fenced with high hedges, fire pits, and hundreds of round earthen houses that bulged from the ground like miniature hills covered with grass. A small army of slaves had gone ahead to prepare for Khal Drogo's arrival. As each rider swung down from his saddle, he unbelted his arak and handed it to a waiting slave, and any other weapon he carried as well. Even Khal Drogo himself was not exempt. Sir Jorah had explained that it was forbidden to carry a blade in Vase Dothrak or to shed a free man's blood. Even warring Khalasars put aside their feuds and shared meat and mead together when they were in sight of the Mother of Mountains. In this place, the crones of the Dashkaleen had decreed all Dothraki were one blood, one Khalasar, one herd. Kohalo came to Danny as Iri and Jiqui were helping her down off her silver. He was the oldest of Drogo's three blood riders, a squat, bald man with a crooked nose and a mouth full of broken teeth, shattered by a mace 20 years before when he saved the young Kalakar from sellswords who hoped to sell him to his father's enemies. His life had been bound to Drogo's the day her lord husband was born. Every Khal had his blood riders. At first, Danny had thought of them as a kind of Dothraki Kingsguard, sworn to protect their lord. But it went further than that. Jiqui had taught her that a blood rider was more than a guard. They were the Khal's brothers, his shadows, his fiercest friends. Blood of my blood, Drogo called them, and so it was. They shared a single life. The ancient traditions of the horse lords demanded that when the Khal died, his blood riders died with him. to ride at his side in the Nightlands. If the Carl died at the hands of some enemy, they lived only long enough to avenge him, and then followed him joyfully into the grave. In some Khalasar, Jikri said, the Blood Riders shared the Carl's wine, his tent, and even his wives, though never his horses. A man's mount was his own. Daenerys was glad that Khal Drogo did not hold to those ancient ways. She should not have liked being shared. And while old Kaholo treated her kindly enough, the others frightened her. Hago, huge and silent, often glared as if he had forgotten who she was. And Cutho had cruel eyes and quick hands that liked to hurt. He left bruises on Daria's soft white skin whenever he touched her, and sometimes made Iris sob in the night. Even his horses seemed to fear him. Yet they were bound to Drogo for life and death, so Daenerys had no choice but to accept them. And sometimes she found herself wishing her father had been protected by such men. In the songs, the White Knights of the Kingsguard were ever noble, valiant and true. And yet, King Aerys had been murdered by one of them, the handsome boy they now call the Kingslayer, and a second, Sir Barristan the Bold, had gone over to the usurper. She wondered if all men were as false in the Seven Kingdoms. When her son sat the Iron Throne, she would see that he had blood riders of his own to protect him against treachery in his King's Guard. Khaleesi, Kaholo said to her in Dothraki, Drogo, who is blood of my blood, commands me to tell you that he must ascend the Mother of Mountains this night to sacrifice to the gods for his safe return. Only men were allowed to set foot on the Mother, Dany knew. The Khal's blood riders would go with him and return at dawn. Tell my sun and stars that I dream of him and wait anxious for his return, she replied, thankful. Dany tired more easily as the child grew within her. In truth, a night of rest would be most welcome. Her pregnancy only seemed to have inflamed Drogo's desire for her, and of late his embraces left her exhausted. Doria led her to the hollow hill that had been prepared for her and her Carl. It was cool and dim within, like a tent made of earth. Jikri, a bath, please, she commanded, to wash the dust of travel from her skin and soak her weary bones. It was pleasant to know they would linger here for a while, that she would not need to climb back on her silver on the morrow. The water was scalding hot, as she liked it. I will give my brother his gifts tonight, she decided as Jikri was washing her hair. He should look a king in the sacred city. Doria, run and find him and invite him to sup with me. Viserys was nicer to the Lycene girl than to her Dothraki handmaids, perhaps because Magister Illyrio had let him bet her back in Pentos. Iri, go to the bazaar and buy fruit and meat, anything but horse flesh. Horse is best, Iri said. Horse makes man strong. Viserys hates horse meat. As you say, Khaleesi. She brought back a haunch of goat and a basket of fruits and vegetables. Jikri roasted the meat with sweet grass and fire pods, basting it with honey as it cooked. And there were melons and pomegranates and plums and some queer eastern fruit Dany did not know. While her handmaids prepared the meal, Dany laid out the clothing she had had made to her brother's measure, a tunic and leggings of crisp white linen, leather sandals that laced up to the knee, a bronze medallion belt, a leather vest painted with fire-breathing dragons. The Dothraki would respect him more if he looked less like a beggar, she hoped, and perhaps he would forgive her for shaming him that day in the grass. He was still her king, after all, and her brother. They were both blood of the dragon. She was arranging the last of his gifts, a sand silk cloak, green as grass with a pale grey border that would bring out the silver in his hair, when Viserys arrived, dragging Doria by the arm. Her eye was red where he'd hit her. How dare you send this whore to give me commands, he said. He shoved the handmaid roughly to the carpet. The anger took Dany utterly by surprise. I only wanted Goria, what did you say?
Khaleesi, pardons, forgive me. I went to him as you bid and told him you commanded him to join you for supper.
No one commands a dragon, Viserys snarled. I am your king. I should have sent you back her head. The Lycian girl quailed, but Danny calmed her with a touch. Don't be afraid. He won't hurt you.
Sweet brother, please forgive her. The girl misspoke herself. I told her to ask you to sup with me, if it pleases your grace.
She took him by the hand and drew him across the room. Look, these are for you. Viserys frowned suspiciously.
What is all this?
New raiment. I had it made for you. Danny smiled shyly. He looked at her and sneered.
Dothraki rags! Do you presume to dress me now?
Please, you'll be cooler and more comfortable. And I thought, maybe if you dress like them, the Dothraki. Danny did not know how to say it without waking his dragon.
Next, you'll want to braid my hair.
I'd never... Why was he always so cruel? She had only wanted to help. You have no right to a braid. You have won no victories yet. It was the wrong thing to say. Fury shone from his lilac eyes, yet he dare not strike her, not with a handmaid watching and the warriors of her cars outside. Viserys picked up the cloak and sniffed at it.
This stinks of manure. Perhaps I shall use it as a horse blanket.
I had Doria sew it specially for you, she told him, wounded.
These are garments fit for a carl.
I am the lord of the Seven Kingdoms, not some grass-stained savage with bells in his hair.
Viserys spat back at her. He grabbed her arm.
You forget yourself, slut. Do you think that big belly will protect you if you wake the dragon?
His fingers dug into her arm painfully, and for an instant, Danny felt like a child again, quailing in the face of his rage. She reached out with her other hand and grabbed the first thing she touched, the belt she hoped to give him, a heavy chain of ornate bronze medallions. She swung it with all her strength. It caught him full in the face. Viserys let go of her. Blood ran down his cheek where the edge of one of the medallions had sliced it open.
You are the one who forgets himself, Danny said to him. Didn't you learn anything that day in the grass? Leave me now, before I summon my cars to drag you out, and pray that Khal Drogo does not hear of this, or he will cut open your belly and feed you your own entrails.
Viserys scrambled back to his feet.
When I come into my kingdom, you will rue this day, slut.
He walked off, holding his torn face, leaving her gifts behind him. Drops of his blood had spattered the beautiful sand silk cloak. Danny clutched the soft cloth to her cheek and sat cross-legged on her sleeping mats. Your supper is ready, Khaleesi, Jiqui announced. I'm not hungry, Danny said sadly. She was suddenly very tired. Share the food among yourselves and send some to Ser Jorah, if you would. After a moment, she added, please bring me one of the dragon's eggs. Iri fetched the egg with a deep green shell, bronze flecks shining amid its scales as she turned it in her small hands. Danny curled up on her side, pulling the sand silk cloak across her and cradling the egg in the hollow between her swollen belly and small, tender breasts. She liked to hold them. They were so beautiful, and sometimes just being close to them made her feel stronger, braver, as if somehow she were drawing strength from the stone dragons locked inside. She was lying there, holding the egg, when she felt the child move within her, as if he were reaching out, brother to brother, blood to blood.
You are the dragon, Danny whispered to him. The true dragon. I know it. I know it.
And she smiled and went to sleep, dreaming of home. Bran. A light snow was falling. Bran could feel the flakes on his face melting as they touched his skin like the gentlest of rains. He sat straight atop his horse, watching as the iron portcullis was winched upward. Try as he might to keep calm, his heart was fluttering in his chest.
Are you ready? Rob asked.
Bran nodded, trying not to let his fear show. He had not been outside Winterfell since his fall, but he was determined to ride out as proud as any knight.
Let's ride then.
Rob put his heels into his big grey and white gelding, and the horse walked onto the portcullis.
Go,
Bran whispered to his own horse. He touched her neck lightly, and the small chestnut filly started forward. Bran had named her Dancer. She was 2 years old, and Joseph had said she was smarter than any horse had a right to be. They had trained her special to respond to rein and voice and touch. Up to now, Bran had only ridden her around the yard. At first, Joseph or Hodor would lead her, while Bran sat strapped to her back in the oversized saddle the imp had drawn up for him. But for the past fortnight, he had been riding her on his own, trotting her round and round and growing bolder with every circuit. They passed beneath the gatehouse, over the drawbridge, through the outer walls. Summer and Grey Wind came loping beside them, sniffing at the wind. Close behind came Theon Greyjoy, with his long bow and a quiver of broadheads. He had a mind to take a deer, he had told them. He was followed by four guardsmen in mail shirts and coifs, and Joseph, a stick-thin stableman, whom Rob had named Master of Horse while Holland was away. Maester Lewin brought up the rear, riding on a donkey. Bran would have liked it better if he and Rob had gone off alone, just the two of them, but Hal Mollen would not hear of it, and Maester Lewin backed him. If Bran fell off his horse or injured himself, the maester was determined to be with him. Beyond the castle lay the market square, its wooden stalls deserted now. They rode down the muddy streets of the village, past rows of small, neat houses of log and undressed stone. Less than one in five were occupied, thin tendrils of wood smoke curling up from their chimneys. The rest would fill up one by one as it grew colder. When the snow fell and the ice winds howled down out of the north, old Nan said, farmers left their frozen fields and distant holdfasts, loaded up their wagons, and then the winter town came alive. Bran had never seen it happen, but Maester Lewin said the day was looming closer. The end of the long summer was near at hand. Winter is coming. A few villagers eyed the dire wolves anxiously as the riders went past, and one man dropped the wood he was carrying as he shrank away in fear. But most of the town folk had grown used to the sight. They bent the knee when they saw the boys, and Rob greeted each of them with a lordly nod. With his legs unable to grip, the swaying motion of the horse made Bran feel unsteady at first, but the huge saddle with its thick horn and high back cradled him comfortably, and the straps around his chest and thighs would not allow him to fall. After a time, the rhythm began to feel almost natural. His anxiety faded, and a tremulous smile crept across his face. Two serving wenches stood beneath the sign of the Smoking Log, the local alehouse. When Theon Greyjoy called out to them, the younger girl turned red and covered her face. Theon spurred his mount to move up beside Rob.
Sweet Kyra, he said with a laugh. She squirms like a weasel in bed. But say a word to her on the street and she blushes pink as a maid. Did I ever tell you about the night that she and Bessa...
Not where my brother can hear, Theon, Rob warned him with a glance at Bran. Bran looked away and pretended not to have heard, but he could feel Greyjoy's eyes on him. No doubt he was smiling. He smiled a lot, as if the world were a secret joke that only he was clever enough to understand. Rob seemed to admire Theon and enjoyed his company, but Bran had never warmed to his father's ward. Rob rode closer.
You're doing well, Bran.
I want to go faster, Bran said.
Rob smiled. As you will.
He sent his gelding into a trot. The wolves raced after him. Bran snapped the reins sharply, and Dancer picked up her pace. He heard a shout from Theon Greyjoy and the hoofbeats of the other horses behind him. Bran's cloak billowed out, rippling in the wind, and the snow seemed to rush at his face. Rob was well ahead, glancing back over his shoulder from time to time to make sure Bran and the others were following. He snapped the reins again. Smooth as silk, Dancer slid into a gallop. The distance closed. By the time he caught Rob, on the edge of the Wolf's Wood, 2 miles beyond the winter town, they had left the others well behind. "I can ride!" Bran shouted, grinning. It felt almost as good as flying.
"I'd race you, but I fear you'd win."
Rob's tone was light and joking, yet Bran could tell that something was troubling his brother underneath the smile. "I don't want to race." Bran looked around for the direwolves. Both had vanished into the wood. "Did you hear Summer howling last night?" "Grey Wind was restless too," Rob said. His auburn hair had grown shaggy and unkempt, and a reddish stubble covered his jaw, making him look older than his 15 years. "Sometimes I think they know things, sense things," Rob sighed. "I never know how much to tell you, Bran. I wish you were older." "I'm 8 now," Bran said. 8 isn't so much younger than 15, and I'm the heir to Winterfell after you."
"So you are." Rob sounded sad, and even a little scared.
"Bran, I need to tell you something. There was a bird last night from King's Landing. Maester Lewin woke me." Bran felt a sudden dread. "Dark wings, dark words," old Nan always said. And of late, the messenger ravens had been proving the truth of that proverb. When Rob wrote to the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, the bird that came back brought word that Uncle Benjen was still missing. Then a message had arrived from the Eyrie for Mother. But that had not been good news either. She did not say when she meant to return, only that she had taken the imp as prisoner. Bran had sort of liked the little man, yet the name Lannister sent cold fingers creeping up his spine. There was something about the Lannisters, something he ought to remember, but when he tried to think what, he felt dizzy and his stomach clenched hard as a stone. Rob spent most of that day locked behind closed doors with Maester Lewin, Theon Greyjoy, and Halas Mollen. Afterwards, riders were sent out on fast horses, carrying Rob's commands throughout the north. Bran heard talk of Moat Cailin, the ancient stronghold the first men had built at the top of the neck. No one ever told him what was happening, yet he knew it was not good. And now another raven, another message. Bran clung to hope. Was the bird from Mother? Is she coming home? The message was from Alan in King's Landing. Jorre Cassel is dead, and Will, and Heward as well, murdered by the Kingslayer. Rob lifted his face to the snow, and the flakes melted on his cheeks. May the gods give them rest. Bran did not know what to say. He felt as if he'd been punched. Jorre had been captain of the household guard at Winterfell since before Bran was born. They killed Jorre? He remembered all the times Jorre had chased him over the roofs. He could picture him striding across the yard in mail and plate, or sitting at his accustomed place on the bench in the great hall, joking as he ate. Why would anyone kill Jorre? Rob shook his head numbly, the pain plain in his eyes. I don't know, and, Bran, that's not the worst of it. Father was caught beneath a falling horse in the fight. Alan says his leg was shattered, and Maester Pycelle has given him the milk of the poppy, but they aren't sure when he... The sound of hoofbeats made him glance down the road to where Theon and the others were coming up. When he will wake, Rob finished. He laid his hand on the pommel of his sword then, and he went on in the solemn voice of Rob the Lord. Bran, I promise you, whatever may happen, I will not let this be forgotten. Something in his tone made Bran feel even more fearful. What will you do? He asked as Theon Greyjoy reined in beside them. Theon thinks I should call the banners, Rob said. Blood for blood. For once Greyjoy did not smile. His lean, dark face had a hungry look to it, and black hair fell down across his eyes. Only the Lord can call the banners, Bran said, as the snow drifted down on them. If your father dies, Theon said, Rob will be Lord of Winterfell.
He won't die,
Bran screamed at him. Rob took his hand. He won't die, not father, he said calmly. Still, the honor of the North is in my hands now. When our Lord Father took his leave of us, he told me to be strong for you and for Rickon. I'm almost a man grown, Bran. Bran shivered. I wish Mother was back, he said miserably. He looked around from Mace to Luan. His donkey was visible in the far distance, trotting over a rise. Does Maester Luan say to call the banners too? The Maester is as timid as an old woman, said Theon. Father always listened to his counsel, Bran reminded his brother. Mother too.
I listened to him, Rob said. I listened to everyone.
The joy Bran had felt at the ride was gone, melted away like the snowflakes on his face. Not so long ago, the thought of Rob calling the banners and riding off to war would have filled him with excitement, but now he felt only dread. Can we go back now? He said. I'm cold. Rob glanced around. We need to find the wolves. Can you stand to go a bit longer? I can go as long as you can. Maester Luan had warned him to keep the ride short for fear of saddle sores, but Bran would not admit to weakness in front of his brother. He was sick of the way everyone was always fussing over him and asking how he was. Let's hunt down the hunters then, Rob said. Side by side, they urged their mounts off the King's Road and struck out into the Wolf's Wood. Theon dropped back and followed well behind, talking and joking with the guardsmen. It was nice under the trees. Bran kept Dancer to a walk, holding the reins lightly and looking all around him as they went. He knew this wood, but he had been so long confined to Winterfell that he felt as though he were seeing it for the first time. The smells filled his nostrils, the sharp, fresh tang of pine needles, the earthy odor of wet, rotting leaves, the hint of animal musk and distant cooking fires. He caught a glimpse of a black squirrel moving through the snow-covered branches of an oak and paused to study the silvery web of an emperor spider. Theon and the others fell farther and farther behind until Bran could no longer hear their voices. From ahead came the faint sound of rushing water. It grew louder until they reached the stream. Tears stung his eyes. Bran? Rob asked. What's wrong? Bran shook his head. I was just remembering, he said. Jory brought us here once to fish for trout. You and me and John, do you remember?
I remember, Rob said, his voice quiet and sad.
I didn't catch anything, Bran said, but John gave me his fish on the way back to Winterfell. Will we ever see John again?
We saw Uncle Benjen when the king came to visit, Rob pointed out.
John will visit too, you'll see. The stream was running high and fast. Rob dismounted and led his gelding across the ford. In the deepest part of the crossing, the water came up to mid-thigh. He tied his horse to a tree on the far side and waded back across for Bran and Dancer. The current foamed around rock and root, and Bran could feel the spray on his face as Rob led him over. It made him smile. For a moment, he felt strong again and whole. He looked up at the trees and dreamed of climbing them, right up to the very top, with the whole forest spread out beneath him. They were on the far side when they heard the howl, a long, rising wail that moved through the trees like a cold wind. Bran raised his head to listen. Summer, he said. No sooner had he spoken than a second voice joined the first. They've made a kill, Rob said as he remounted. I'd best go and bring them back. Wait here. Theon and the others should be along shortly. I want to go with you, Bran said. I'll find them faster by myself, Rob spurred his gelding and vanished into the trees. Once he was gone, the woods seemed to close in around Bran. The snow was falling.